Welcome to the Voices in Recovery podcast. Voices in Recovery is produced by Freedom's Path Recovery Society, a registered Canadian charity. If you enjoy the podcast, please consider a donation at www.freedomspathrecoverysociety.ca. All donations go directly to assisting Freedom's Path and providing services free of charge and helps us keep the podcast going. We are grateful for any and all donations. This podcast discusses difficult topics such as childhood abuse, drug and alcohol use, sexuality, sexualized trauma, and more. If you are under the age of 18, please speak with your legal guardian prior to listening. The opinions expressed during the podcast are those of the individual and not those of Voices in Recovery or Freedom's Path Recovery Society. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the podcast.
This podcast is being recorded on the traditional land of the Blackfoot Confederacy. This consists of the Kainai, Piikani, Siksika, and the Blackfeet in the U.S. We acknowledge the Stoney Nakoda, which consists of the Bearspaw, Morley, and Chiniki. We acknowledge the Tsuut'ina who are Dene, and the Métis Inuit status and non-status from all of Turtle Island, and those who are visiting. We are all treaty people.
But yeah, thank you for coming, and we just want to hear everything you have to say. So no pressure.
Yeah.
Everything right. You've ever known.
Yeah, I know. Let's go for it.
Yeah. Well, before the podcast, like we learned that we're both from the States.
Yes.
Yeah. And that we both grew up kind of in California.
Like yeah.
Good different old, parts good of California. Cali, but
yeah.
Yeah.
Growing up in California was just so special in so many different ways. Mm-hmm. It's great to be, on the radio, so to speak, again.
Yeah.
I did my undergrad at San Jose State University, where I essentially grew up. And I
love San Jose, by the way.
Oh, so great.
Such a beautiful place.
Yeah, you gotta love the South Bay.
Yeah.
And I did radio, television, film, and theater. So I was on the radio for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
So this is a very comfortable space for me to be in, being able to talk about anything and everything in an audio format. And I got very, very into music scenes and music culture and, booking shows, hip hop, punk, metal, like all across the board, mostly did music radio. But that was my life for such a long time and is what actually sort of brought me up into Calgary. Mm-hmm. I went to grad school here at University of Calgary.
Okay.
And I was looking at online communities of music scenes and how the mediation of us talking about, you know, going into online communities and talking about music and like, how does that divorce people from the live space where we have like a very like boots on the ground community oriented culture and like, especially the punk and the hip hop scenes. Right. And there's those as places for disruption. And was that being disrupted by online spaces or being inflated? Like we had more marketing and advertising for this type of music, so to speak. And was that a good or a bad thing? Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, a bit of a tangent, but I can't say enough good things about California, just being able to go to all of those different shows and see and go to museums and go to all of these art spaces. Yeah. That's why Calgary became
constant
confusing.
Music.
Yeah. And I guess, you know, we do have that here in Calgary. I came up here for a variety of reasons. Grad school is a great way to get out of the country when you are, you do have that privilege to be able to go to school and go through that system. But,
Right on. Yeah. And so you've been here for
12 years? Yeah. Okay. I've been here for 12 years. I, like I said, I went to grad school up here, stuck around. I was in a relationship with someone for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And, that also kind of brought me up here a bit. But I stuck around because I really like the people. Mm-hmm. I like the community here. And frankly, it's as, I definitely don't want to romanticize being like living in Canada or, you know, so-called Canada, the colonial state.
As Canada with a K.
As an American, I'm doing hand quotes right now, right?
I like to say Canada with a K.
Yeah, no, truly.
America with three Ks.
Yeah,
like those kinds of things.
It's truly, right? Yeah. I mean, even when we talk about California, we got to put Ks in front of that too. Yep. It's like the horrible colonial system that has just desecrated the native peoples, but also we see how this has replicated in the way that we continue to think about like who owns what. Mm-hmm. And if somebody owns something, that means they have power over it, and they have power over those spaces and therefore of those people that inhabit those spaces. So it's been really interesting to kind of look at the interplays between these two spaces, like in the global north. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we always joke as people from California, we go like, oh, we're not Americans, we're Californians. Mm-hmm. And there's that, we've talked about exceptionalism a little bit before this as an American.
Yeah.
But I think it's that same way as like a California, you go like, oh, we're different. We're not in that Trumpster case.
That's
but,
right.
You know, if you look at some of the like addiction, homelessness, harm reduction, like all of these policies, mm-hmm. Institutionalization of people with mental health issues, it mirrors it, and if it's not worse in California, the politics mm-hmm. of it right now in a liberal state, quote, liberal in the American sense, versus here in Alberta, where we're seeing a lot of these same conversations happen in the same ways mm-hmm. about saying like we need to tear down encampments, we need mm-hmm. to institutionalize people, we need to bring back the mental institutions, right?
Don't people remember, like, they must not have any memory or have never done any reading about how fucking horrible those things were when we had them around.
Truly.
The whole reason we entered a period of deinstitutionalization was because of the fucking horrors that were going on in these places. And of course, but if you're of the mindset, any political party, that you want control, that's where you get control. Put people back in buildings, like jails, except call it something else.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's like...
wild.
And it's out of control. And oof. This is where, like, when we start talking about different, like, grand narratives that shape what we... what becomes the norm in society, if we're going to talk about, like, you know, addiction and recovery and what does that mean? What does that mean for harm reduction? What does that mean for people who... are taking different paths, these grand narratives that people are pulling from are from 12-step. And in 12-step, what do they say? That addiction leads to what places? Jails, institution, and death.
Yeah.
So they go, okay, well, since we don't want people to die, now we need to just really make sure that the jails and institutions are there to scare people into these tactics that will make them fit into this normative box that we have decided is what we want society to be.
Yeah.
And when people talk, it's just so silly to me that so many of these, like, hyper right-wing ideologies are all about freedom. Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about what that word means, I mean, freedom recovery, right? Like, what does freedom mean? It doesn't mean, like, you know, gassing up the trucks and, like, you know, pouring through the country screaming and yelling. But, like, you get to decide what that freedom is. But when other people say, like, well, maybe we want to be free from some of these institutions, some of these 12-step narratives, some of these pieces of, frankly, like, based in puritanical and religious sources.
I was going to suggest even, like, outdated, when they try to include science, it's outdated science anyway, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, the science-y part of that big book, just to name one of them, is incomplete. It's utterly incomplete and in so many ways false, right?
Like, absolutely.
It still claims falsehoods that doctors and scientists and researchers have proven not to be the case
exactly.
in some cases, right? So,
and we see it all across
but
the
it
board.
Hasn't changed.
No, and it's still considered gospel or you know, for lack of a better word.
I think it's a good word because UCP took it as gospel and they're going to force people into treatment because of it.
Exactly.
Right?
And then I'll look at some of these treatment centers and their resources. And I was on one the other day that it surprised me a bit given the narrative behind this particular treatment center.
Mm.
And it clicked to something that talked about alcohol MD. So already you're making it seem like it's a medical idea.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes you to this like 1990s GeoCities looking blog where they talk about how now that we know that alcohol is a brain disease because science says so, I was like, okay.
Science didn't say that.
Let's let
some
the,
scientists might say that, but that
yes,
doesn't mean science says that.
Exactly, yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean, and that's a whole other conversation about like who gets to decide what is objective and what is not.
100%.
And there's a variety of like... You know, we talk about variables and controls in science, and if you're able to cherry pick what those are, you're going to be able to push the results to where you want them to go.
Which is 100% the 12-step narrative. You push the results to what you want. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you, and by weeding out people who don't comply, I'm using quotation marks as well, because in those institutions, much like the 12 steps is an institution, I don't give a shit what anybody says, because I've been only in two other places where people get so mad when you counter them. Church, police, and the rooms, 12-step rooms. So, because if you have a counter argument, you are out.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And you'll be outed quick, because what people will do in those rooms sometimes is they'll make other people feel like they're in danger by listening to that person. Mm-hmm. When really, sometimes that person is trying to, like, alert people, right?
And, exactly.
And then they end up getting worked out of it because of the structure, right?
And the... So I wrote my master's thesis on my relationship with alcohol, which I define my... I use the words alcoholic for myself, problematic drinking, all of these different types of things. And I realize all of those words are heavy and have a lot of implications. But I do think it's important that we're able to self-identify as we can choose.
Self whatever we want, yeah.
Right? And I grew up in those rooms. Like, both of my parents, you too, yeah. It's like I was indoctrinated into 12-step very early on from sitting in, you know, the side rooms as a kid, not really paying attention. Maybe walking out like quickly and quietly to pick up some of the snacks, right? Walking back into the rooms, watching tube TV. You know, I'm talking like 6, 7, 8 years old, really, really young, really impressionable. And I continued to go into these rooms and these spaces. And as I got older, I'd sit in to the, you know, there were open meetings, right? And I started to be like, wow, these people have so much confidence. So I'm like this preteen teenager, and I literally looked up to a lot of these people. And I'm not saying that all of them didn't maybe deserve that.
For sure, some probably did.
Of course, For sure. And I, you know, a lot of it is really similar, but I'd say just due to the amount of people in California, I think that they had more room to create 12-step spaces that were... like some people would rewrite the book entirely and be like, it's anti-feminist, this For the Wives chapter is garbage. And they would create almost like a new situation, a new community, but realizing that they had to have that 12-step marker on it or else people wouldn't take it seriously.
And that's the same as the church, right? They dull down whatever dogma was in the original books and they start making their own books.
Yeah.
So it's more palatable for us, right?
Like totally.
And all I mean by palatable doesn't mean it's better. Mm-mm. It just means it's more digestible.
Yeah.
So what they've done in the rooms, as you're pointing out, is that like making religion digestible to people who are not religious.
Yeah. What are they? God doesn't have to be anything. It can be a doorknob. I'm like, but you're still creating a deity or an otherworld, not even a deity, an otherworldly idea that's like, oh, well, you need to realize that you don't have total control over yourself, which I think is how we drive people into institutionalization.
100%.
Right?
Well, first of all, we don't like it when people are out of control.
No.
So if you're out of control, we just want you to be under control because it makes us feel better, right?
Correct.
Less worried about you, less worried about us, less, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that's all very, very true. And I feel like that dance between, oh, well, 12-step, look at it. It's this grassroots collection of people. It's decentralized. And I'm like, AA, NA, all that, incredibly centralized.
Incredibly centralized and incredibly hierarchical.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, without question. Even though they'll tell you, like, till they're blue in the face, it's not. It's 100% hierarchical.
Yeah. You know, there are norms, there are values that come in there. I think the only, like, in my research slash, like, lived experience, it all kind of muddled together in this work that I was doing. Like, I went to AA after I was like, oh, right, I have some major issues with drinking that I need to handle, because that's all I knew. That's all I knew what to do was I'm like, okay, I'm going to go into these rooms. And I was here in Calgary. And I had, you know, I was reading through my thesis again, kind of preparing through this, and also looking at it, because I wrote that, like, I don't know, 7 years ago, and some of the things I see shifted, I was like, oh, I really did think that it was, oh, this is because it's Calgary, and it's more conservative, it's a different, there's less people versus California, where it's more open, maybe that's where the problem is, but looking back, I'm like, nah, it was the exact same thing, the exact same problem, and when I went into these spaces, first off, being a femme-presenting person in these spaces, all of a sudden, I have nothing but masked dudes coming up to me, hitting on me, asking me to go out for coffee. Like, it wasn't safe in that regard, and I recognized that immediately, and it made me go, this 12-step thing that I thought was safe mm-hmm. as a child, being brought in and indoctrinated in this space.
And protected by your parents at that point.
Exactly. Yeah. And being told, oh, well, this is the safe place that you go mm-hmm. when you have a problem or yeah. that, or your life feels out of control. This is a safe space that you go.
It's very safe.
The church, right? Yeah, it's very similar.
That's right, 100%. It's very safe for, unless you're a female by yourself.
Totally.
A queer person or a person of color or a black person or indigenous. Otherwise, it's fine.
1,000%, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm a white, queer, cis person.
Yeah.
And, well, you know, cis-ish. I always say I'm femme-ish around those ways.
I was always cis-passing, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Until the last few years.
So. Yeah. No, I feel that. And, like, it has been quite the journey, to steal one of their stupid words, to work my way out of that indoctrination of 12-step.
Yeah.
And what I found was I looked at the Reddit group Stop Drinking. Mm-hmm. And that was what really helped me just to be able to, that community connection. Mm-hmm. Like, I won't take that away from 12-step. Like,
there's something to it, for sure.
Matters.
Yeah.
But when we start to take community and confine it, within it's like, oh, well, we have these 12 steps and these 12 traditions, and we got to follow these, but also like kind of not follow them. Mm-hmm. Like they really pick and choose how they play that game.
Well said. It's very pick and choosy.
It became, I was like, well, okay, now I don't know what to do. And because I had all of this experience looking at like mm-hmm. online mediated spaces and kind of these live spaces, I was stuck. I was in grad school. I wanted to stay here. That was how I immigrated here. That's how I was going to be able to stay in this country, not have to go back to the States. And I was so consumed with that identity change that happens when you're like, okay, I almost have built this identity around like my substance or my, the substance that I use, which was alcohol. Mm-hmm. And that was the most problematic one for me. I'll put it that way.
Yeah.
How am I supposed to both have support for this behavioral change without mm-hmm. being institutionalized? Because if I were to have gone to rehab or treatment, as they call it here, that would have taken me out of grad school. Mm-hmm. And like, you don't, when you come here on a student visa, you don't have the luxury of stopping these things. Both of my parents passed away while I was in grad school.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. It was.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, at separate times for different reasons,
Jesus.
But it was like, okay, they were really good about letting me like fly back mm-hmm. and like a lot of graduate school is a lot of like reading and writing on your mm-hmm. own. But I was in survival mode because mm-hmm. I'm like, not only do I have to go through all of this grief and all of this trauma and like relive all of these other things mm-hmm. that I'm going through. Now I've realized that I've been using alcohol to cope with, now what I know is undiagnosed neurodivergence, mm-hmm. undiagnosed mental health issues mm-hmm. That have now been, I mean, it doesn't matter if they're diagnosed or not, but at least a diagnosis for me has made it easier for me to access appropriate services.
To treat it,
yeah. right? Because I immediately just, you know, I'm like, well, and I think there's an American thing to this too. It's like mm-hmm. going to the doctor costs money.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to talk about that now with what's going on in Alberta because... Yeah. So many of us self-medicate because that is the option. I remember, falling, getting stitches, whatever else, and taking out my own stitches because mm-hmm. it was cheaper than going to the doctor. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, weighing in your hands whether or not it's good enough. Man, do I want to go into bankruptcy for going to the ER mm-hmm. for a $10,000, $15,000, $30,000 medical bill?
Yeah.
Right? It's just so interesting to me, like how we are looking at privatizing so many of these spaces mm-hmm. and creating more barriers to things like detox and treatment mm-hmm. that I'm not going to say that those aren't things that shouldn't be there. We need more of them.
We need more.
We need more beds.
100%.
We need more of these spaces. People want it too.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that we don't need things in additional to that so people can...
Well, because what folks have to understand about these institutions that have these beds, that provide the beds, is that the bigger you make those institutions, the more they feel like they're the only ones that matter.
Exactly.
And that's part of the trouble here, mm-hmm. right? Is that we've found, at least that I found being downtown again, and working amongst other orcs that are more grassroots, more like on the street doing the work, I realized there's this huge disconnect, right? Like from being in those orgs that don't have to worry about money because everybody loves them because they have beds, which is great. We need beds. We just said that. But it doesn't mean that's all we have. Yeah. And it doesn't mean that's all they need. Like, because you can go to one of these institutions that's like, I won't use any names of these treatment centers, but there's some in town here that are 100% based on the 12 steps and God. Mm-hmm. A requirement in those places, having worked at one of them, listening to people talk about how much you need God is fucking revolting, right?
Yep. Like,
but that, and I say that not because people don't need God. I say it because it's revolting to tell people that's what you need to get sober and get well.
Yeah.
That's revolting to me. Because that's not true.
No.
Right?
What we need is housing and structural supports and food security. The thing that is going to...
The answer to poverty.
The answer to poverty, correct. Yeah. Like, the thing that kept me away from wellness and that brings me great, like, visceral fear is the uncertainty that poverty brings, right? Mm. And when you grow up poor, I did not grow up with money back home, you are constantly afraid of being unhoused. Mm-hmm. You are constantly afraid of showing up at the food bank and they're not going to have anything left for you. Mm-hmm. Like, and that trauma from poverty doesn't go away.
No.
And so when they go, hey, we have this big, shiny, bright institution where you get a bed and we're going to feed you. Mm-hmm. And all you got to do is come to a couple of these meetings and talk about God.
Mm-hmm.
When you're unhoused or you are so afraid that like you are not going to be able to pay your rent and that you might be living in your car again or living in like, you know, really, really cheap motel rooms, living on the streets again, that doesn't sound so bad. You will do anything to be housed, to be fed, to be in those spaces. And then I think this is the saddest part is when you don't succumb to the control that those spaces want you to...
Well, they kick you out.
Yeah, they'll kick you out.
Oh, yeah.
And they'll make you feel like crap about it.
Well, it's your fault.
Yeah,
yeah, it's your fault we had to kick you out. We're really sorry that you made us do this.
Yeah, truly.
Right? Like, that's the answer you'll get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And...
Which is fucking ludicrous.
Yeah. Well, and that's... And we keep pointing at this, like, individualism, and it's like, oh, well... you have to make the choice to not be addicted anymore. You have to make those choices. And it's like, well, maybe if people weren't in a constant state of fear and anxiety.
And stress.
And stress. And they weren't self-medicating for these things, these social determinants of health, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's poverty that we need to address first. Mm-hmm. It's the structural things that we need to address. Are there individual aspects of addiction and mental health and all of that? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But they have to be hand in hand. Like, we keep, Alberta right now keeps talking about recovery capital, which to me, I'm like, they've just like reworded what social determinants of health are.
They're just making it so they can make money off it.
Exactly. They're trying to make money off it. But what they've done is they've taken something like, they go, oh, recovery capital is like stable housing, being able to have access to food, having access to supportive community. Mm-hmm. They've made this a reward for recovery, but really what it is like essential and foundational for people to be able to be in a space where they can engage in recovery in a way that works for them. Mm-hmm. Without those spaces, people go like, oh, well, do you ever think about drinking again? People, I don't know why people ask me this. I don't know if you've come across this. They go, well, what if someone gave you $100,000? Would you take a shot? And I'm like, fuck, yes, I would.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, the reason why is because I'm exchanging that exact thing for cash, for means to live, for a space to be able to have that, right?
And what difference does it make?
What difference does it make? And I it's always drinkers that ask me this question.
Well, mostly probably AA drinkers that ask you that question.
Oh, AA drinkers?
Or sober alcoholics.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And I'm like... We can't divorce the fact that we have like material needs and the fact that these material needs aren't being met is one of the reasons why
we drink
or we use or we do any of these other things, right? I think alcohol is really an interesting substance to talk about when we start talking about control because, and this is where, you know, maybe the harm reductionists will get upset with me, but I promise you I have some readings that will bring you into this space with me. It's like, we do need to talk about the harms that alcohol causes.
Of course we do.
And I don't think that anyone's ever said, like, hey, let's just talk about how great drug use is and that there's no harms there, like harm reduction. But when we start thinking about alcohol as, if we talk about big pharma, where are we talking about big alcohol?
Yeah.
I think we really need to look at that.
I kind of think we are, to be honest, When you talk about one, you kind of, for me, both of them are there because alcohol is so big.
Yes.
And that was my chemical of choice too, right?
So, mm-hmm.
And I haven't had to drink in a long time,
regardless
of what they say in the rooms or don't say, right? Like
exactly.
The truth of the matter is, like, I don't know why I haven't had to drink. I just haven't, right?
Yeah.
Like, and it's not like I did anything great. Mm-hmm. I didn't. I haven't been a perfect person. I haven't done things perfectly. Like, even in connection to those programs, I haven't been perfect. So,
yeah.
Like, how is it possible that I'm here and other people aren't? It's fucking luck.
Yeah, truly.
And a lot to do with my privilege.
I would say privilege is a huge factor in this, too.
Well, I
think
privilege creates a lot of luck.
Oh, yeah. Surprise, right? It's like people go make better choices. And I'm like, why don't you give people better choices? And then they'll be able to make those choices.
Yeah, but if you give a person a choice over you, if you drink, you don't get the 100,000.
Yeah.
That's like saying, well, go ahead and have a drink, right? Right.
And because alcohol is so like socially accepted and infused in our society, like I got being in recovery and choosing not to drink all of a sudden stigmatized me in kind of this weird backwards way. Like I'm always curious about like, so we have a lot of these pro-treatment things that are happening now, and there's conferences and there's talks and there's panelists. I'm like, how
five
many
or
of
six
them,
a year now, yeah.
They're everywhere.
Yeah.
How many of them are serving cocktails? Because every other academic conference I've been to, there is wine and cheese session, right? And it's time for you to network. And the idea of people sitting around talking about how terrible of an idea like opiate safe supply is or methamphetamine safe supply is over a glass of wine is bonkers.
Or their third scotch or whatever the fuck.
Yeah. Oh, God, right?
Yeah. It's bonkers because without it, people are going to die. Just like they would if we still had to make liquor in our toilet because of like whatever they called that when they tried to get rid of drinking.
Oh, right?
Prohibition.
Sorry. Prohibition,
The word escaped me. But it's like the same thing as prohibition. It didn't go away.
No.
Like, it just got worse.
Exactly.
And then people had to commit crimes.
Yes.
So then you've basically made this whole other industry. Because there's a whole industry that deals with the crimes of drugs. So, and that was one of those things that most people don't realize. Like, you don't understand. Why would the police agree to, like, force treatment? Why do you think? Because they have enough numbers to force people into treatment.
Yeah.
And to them, it answers a problem. It's a, it's an answer to a long-ass problem. What do we do? And I say long only because most of the cops now wouldn't remember institutionalization.
Yeah.
Not that they can't read. I'm sure they can. But it's like when you look back at that, you have to realize we're just there again because we get scared at the same thing every time.
Yeah.
Humans just get fucking scared and we go, ah, let's lock everybody up.
Yep.
Because that's all we've done.
Yeah.
I mean, from the time the colonists came here and the settlers came here, that's all we've done.
Yeah.
Is we've shut people up by creating more institutions, more committees.
Yeah.
We separate us from each other so that we are scared of each other. And then we say, oh, no, we better have abstinence, right?
Yep.
I heard this one time, and this is where I think about, I wish people, somehow we could show people who've never worked in the field or in the area. Like, I just wish we could just transmit that sense of feeling when you see someone who can't get it the way people are telling them to, and they die.
Yeah.
Like, I'd really like to transmit that pain to people so they could feel what it's like to know that that person did everything they could.
Mm-hmm.
Everything they could, considering everything about them, and they died.
Yeah.
Is it their fault? Of course not. Like, this is, if we're dealing with an illness, like, if we start talking about, like, a mental illness, and if alcoholism is that, which I am not saying one way or the other, I am saying that, for me, alcohol was a killer.
Yeah.
I don't know what it did, all the intricacies to my brain and all that stuff, but I do know the difference between Dave without booze and Dave with booze.
Yeah.
Right?
Totally.
But it's not because someone said, you have to do all these things.
No.
It was literally like just not drinking.
And that for me was the end of it was like, I didn't have to follow all those rules and those steps and everything else. Yeah. It was like, I don't count. It's been several years since I've had a drink. And I don't even think about it in the same way because for me, I just go like, it's too much anxiety for me to be like, okay, I can only have two drinks and then focus just on having those two drinks, right? And I don't know where, I don't know if I was socialized that way growing up in 12-step, being told that there's a binary of people that can use and then there's people that can't.
Black and white.
Yeah, that black and white notion, it's like that has been instilled into me since I was, you know, a child. And
like in so many ways too, eh?
Oh, and it's just, you know, and I never even got to learn how to drink appropriately, right? All I ever saw was stuff on the media, right? And if we talk about like, okay, I'm like, oh, look, they're drinking alcohol or they're drinking beer or, you know, these groups of people are able to do it that way. Like my favorite TV shows, these are the people I'm like being a latchkey kid with addict parents, like, and that's how they describe themselves. I didn't have, no one taught me how to drink appropriately. And the thing that happens is when you learn from the media is when's on your favorite TV show, think of listeners, when's the last time that you saw that person be hungover from drugs or alcohol, right?
Never.
When's the last time that you saw people live their real life, go to the bathroom, brush their teeth, like, you know, without fancy lighting? Like, when we start to look at these mediations of what we're supposed to be replicating in life without strong social support in our actual real lives, we start to divorce the idealization or the romanticization of what that use looks like and the socialization of it. That's what I really wanted. I wanted friends. I wanted community. And I found that through music scenes and through drinking, frankly. Do I still hang out and do music stuff? Absolutely. COVID's made things a little bit weirder now in just like the live music sense. Things are kind of back. But, and it's like when I walk into these spaces where I used to drink, I'm not like, oh my God, I wish I could drink right now. It's actually like, and it's not even like, oh, the drinkers. It's complete divorcing from it. I don't even really think about it. And the only time I start to think about it is if I see someone who might like, you know, what if somebody like trips and falls or like you see that someone might be, have had their drink, altered by somebody like roofied or something like that, then I'm paying attention to like the behaviors that are in regard to use. But otherwise, I think people get this idea that people who are sober or whatever, that we're always on this edge of using again because you know, it's like 12 Step says in the same fucking breath, one day at a time, you're an addict forever. And I'm like, okay, here we have another binary where there is no through line to figure out like, okay, well, what's the process of living through all of these things? How do we both live one day at a time and also accept the fact that we are othered from normative society?
We have been altered,
Yeah. And then as we become, when we do become people that are involved in recovery, now we're tokenized. Now we're told like, oh, come speak at our event. Like, I mean, you probably get this all the time with your law enforcement background. I can imagine.
I had been asked, but I stopped doing it a couple years ago.
Yeah,
I just stopped because I was like, I don't know what I'm saying anymore. And, and for me, that was a big deal. Like I was like, there's some things that I say that I'm not sure I believe, right? And so like I had to really look at that. But yeah, I won't speak at these conferences. I just won't because and not because I think inherently they're bad. That's not what I mean. What I think is it's a waste of time. That's what I think.
Truly.
We know what the fucking problems are. We know what we need to do. The truth is we don't want to actually do the things. We don't want to address poverty because we're capitalists. We don't want to, because it's always the people's fault for not working hard enough. Right? Like, so we're not going to address that. And until we address that, my mind is, we cannot address the other things. We can do the work day to day, of course, because we have to, or else people die. But in terms of talking about it, how much more talk do we need to do about the 12 steps?
Truly.
Right? Like, how much more do we need to give that process when there's a good portion of humans that don't believe in any God? Which is fair, because everything about my life, from the time I was born, don't get me wrong, if you ask my parents, they would say different, but if you ask me, I would say God never existed. That, if I look back honestly, and between you and me, and I honestly say that, I would say there has never been a God because humans are fucked. And we're an example, I think. If it was just up to the animals, I might believe in God. Right? But it's not. It's up to us too, right? Oh, sorry. That was my arm hitting
It's okay.
hitting the table. But it's like that to me is problematic, of course, right? And of course, I was raised in a church. So
yeah.
any sort of evangelical stuff is problematic to me. Like, mm-hmm. especially when we start saying this fits everybody. Like, to me, I know that's instantly not true.
Yeah.
Like, especially depending on who's fucking offering it, right?
Yes.
Like, if you have a cross on your neck, like, chances are, or you've got a Bible in your hand, mm-hmm. chances are it's offered with some sort of, you have to reply with something. You have to conform to some extent, whether it's pray for your supper. Like, mm-hmm. And I've encountered that being downtown again, when people come to talk with me and they say, do we have to pray first? And I'm like, absolutely fucking not. You don't have yeah. to do anything. Like, if you don't want to talk, you don't have to talk. But if you want to, you can, right? Like,
I mean, it's instilled so deeply. Yeah. When they open up assembly and they open up parliament, they open it with a prayer.
Yes, and they tell us it's church and state are separate, right?
And then they go, oh, yeah. and we really care about reconciliation. Here are these 94 acts of reconciliation yeah. that we're really gonna do. But at the same time, I'm like, wasn't that the point of the residential schools, to like really literally beat God into people mm-hmm. and take away their way of living and knowing? Mm-hmm. I mean, the great irony of people escaping persecution, coming over to, Turtle Island over here mm-hmm. and desecrating other people for thinking differently from them is never lost on me.
Me neither.
And we're continuing to do that thing again mm-hmm. and again and again. And we're tokenizing voices of people who, you know, I don't want to take away anybody's experience of mm-hmm. being indigenous or being racialized or being mm-hmm. queer. But why is it that all of the people who make it up in this white supremacist system, mm-hmm. are they not replicating that same whiteness? Have they mm-hmm. not captured that same elitism? And they're like, okay, I've made it now. I'm in the room with all the white people that make mm-hmm. decisions. Are you making decisions for your people? Or are you making decisions that continue to keep this same system mm-hmm. at play?
Yeah. And I think that's a good point, because I think within those institutions, there's probably more so of the latter,
yeah.
that more so of those who protect the institution. And part of that, what I've had to really fucking think about this, because I have friends that are on the job, that are police, right?
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of weeks ago, we had a member from law enforcement
yeah.
From Canada come on and talk about some of this stuff. And what always comes up after that, those conversations is, okay, so I look at it like, I know some really good humans mm-hmm. who also happen to be like in law enforcement or whatever.
Totally.
But of course, from the outside, I only know them as humans, right? So mm-hmm. I don't know them as officers. I know them as people.
Like, exactly.
So for my brain, somehow that makes it able to go, okay, they're not all bad, right?
Mm-hmm.
But people have been asking me this question and posing this question to me, so I'll pose it to you.
Yeah.
Is because if I stay in the institution, even if my intention is to try to change it. Now, that was my intention at one point, was
yeah.
to actually literally be there to try to affect change.
Mm-hmm.
Naive of me, for sure, because these institutions are ingrained, right? And they're
yeah.
not going to give up easily,
exactly.
as we've seen, right? We
mm-hmm.
have, I mean, in Calgary, we have, I cannot remember hearing a police chief, except for some that I've heard from the States, like Arizona and stuff,
yeah.
talk like our police chief talks. Like, he's a Wild West Ugh. Fucking sheriff,
yeah.
right? And on top of that, now he's suing somebody. It's like the police's
yeah.
answer to everything is, we're going to sue you if you talk shit about us.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is crazy.
Taylor right? McNally, a black activist, is
yes.
being sued actively right now by a constable saying that they didn't do this thing that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, that's your answer, is to sue black activists?
Yeah.
And to keep black activists out of racial justice conferences,
mm-hmm.
talking about their experiences mm-hmm. of the racist system in, you know, Canada mm-hmm. with a K, like,
yeah.
What side of history do we want to be on? The one where we're in a conference that replicates like the white academic
mindset of racism?
Mindset and that
yeah.
that same system? Or do we want to be on the side of history, of the pamphlets that we talk about
mm-hmm.
now in history, and the people that we talk about in history
mm-hmm.
who really did bring civil liberties forward and
yeah.
bring liberation forward.
At great cost to themselves.
1,000%.
Yeah.
Like, literally murdered.
Much like, yeah, much like Taylor, right? They've
yeah.
tried to murder her. They've tried to murder her reputation. They've worked so hard to just crush her. And this goes back to when I was still, like, I was finishing my time working with CPS. Maybe over a year ago. It was over a year ago. Yeah, I can't remember now when it was. But it was over a year ago. And after I posted one of her, I shared one of her things
mm-hmm.
on my social media, I got a phone call from a cop. And you can you imagine what the cop said?
Oh, geez.
Yeah. I can tell you. He said, "Oh, we noticed that you're sharing Taylor stuff. Yeah, we don't like Taylor. There's a group of us that really don't like her." Mm-hmm. And so my answer was, "Well, that's too fucking bad." And I hung up the phone and quit working with the police because I knew that was inevitable. And if anyone ever makes me choose, they're out. Like, if you have to try to control who I'm talking to, what I'm doing, and it's not like I'm going to Klan rallies, so let's be honest, okay, because that's not what was happening.
Totally.
Not going to Klan rallies, I'm not part of the freedom movement, mm-hmm. I'm not none of that shit, okay? I'm literally supporting a person who absolutely needs support and deserves it. Mm-hmm. Because this person, Taylor specifically, is trying to do for us what none of us can do.
Yeah.
What none of us even think we need to do, mm-hmm. right? And it's not just her. I don't mean to put her in the spotlight always, but I mean, here in Calgary, she is, right?
So, yeah, especially right now.
Yeah, right now. But there's so many people like her, mm-hmm. right? Like Darcy's wife. I was down at that racism conference outside with Taylor and a couple of the Walls Down folks, mm-hmm. and we were chatting. And Darcy's wife, Michelle, went to go into the conference, and they wouldn't let her in because she was friends with Taylor. And she's a vocal supporter of Taylor. Mm-hmm. And she came right out to us. It was heartbreaking for me to see, mm-hmm. because I can only imagine how that felt for a person being told, no, you can't be friends with them.
Yeah.
Or else you're not allowed to be with us. And that is exactly the cop's mentality.
Yeah.
Is you either conform to our way of thinking, right? You either keep your anger down. We can handle you as long as you're not mad, right?
Yeah.
But as soon as you get mad, we get scared.
Yeah.
Because we're so jumpy about anger, and the cops are so jumpy these days, hey? Like,
oh, absolutely.
Oh my God. I mean, the fact that we don't have a shooting by a policeman every week is pretty amazing, considering how jumpy they are.
Yeah, right? I'm so I'm sitting here, like, part of me is like, where is the training? Where are all these things? But in the end, it's like, we're still handing people deadly weapons under the guise of, okay, make sure you control people that are acting mm-hmm. out sort of in this way, mm-hmm. right? So no matter, you can have the best training, you can have like a bunch of non-crisis violent intervention training, you can have all these things, but in the end, the system is still broken. And like, yes, we do have intersecting identities as human beings, just to get back to your original question.
For sure.
It's like, can we be, you know, even, I'm just gonna say civil, not even close or whatever, to people as like actual human beings outside of their work identities, outside of their other sort of social identities, mm-hmm. that once you strip those away and you're able to be like closer with that actual vulnerable human being, awesome, mm-hmm. that's great. But that same vulnerable human being, they mask that vulnerability, or not even mask, they put on armor to protect that vulnerability, mm-hmm. and able to be in that hyper-controlled us versus them space, mm-hmm. being a police officer, being a pastor, mm-hmm. Being anybody that has to say like, okay, well, I have to make sure that I outline what rules and regulations mm-hmm. and norms are allowed in this space, because my job is part of the system of control. Mm-hmm. So I think that when we start to actually like just tear apart, like stop looking at direct police officers, mm-hmm. this person, that person, the other thing, it's like all of this is meant to control people in a specific and certain way.
Exactly. And that's why no matter who the police officers are, they always fall into the same patterns.
Exactly.
Right? Like, and I guarantee you they didn't all start the same.
Yeah.
Right? But the trouble with being on that job is that you're around way more people that don't like others than do. Mm-hmm. Like you're around, there's a higher percentage of people on the job that are judgmental, angry, hostile about their judgments, and don't give a fuck who knows it.
Yeah.
Right? And so, unfortunately, that is the norm. That's why the culture is so messed up. That's why we'll probably have more humans come on from different law enforcement places talking about the rape culture, right? Is because it's just so, and to me, when I say that out loud, mm-hmm. I think, okay, are you being like, are you exaggerating? Are you doing, and I'm like, no.
No.
The truth is, we're not exaggerating. And women have been talking about this for fucking years.
Yeah.
Whether it's military or law enforcement, they've been talking about mm-hmm. it for years, and we haven't done shit.
Yeah.
Because it's worse now. From what I can tell, it's worse. Like, it's more rampant. And, of course, the men, and even now, and even within those environments, there's women who protect the men who are doing it, because those women don't want to be ostracized.
Well, and they have to replicate they have to replicate that maleness, or that the thing in the patriarchy that says, like, oh, well, to be able to stay in this system, I have to be more like a man.
Yep.
And that is where things get confusing. I was listening to a talk or something by, I think her name's Dr. Stephanie Covington, something like that. And she works a lot about justice for women. And she uses the term male and female because she goes, that's how the systems are set up, is you have females are brought into one carceral system and males are brought into another system. Yeah. And then she was talking about the military, the U.S. military. And she goes, you know, men in the military, their biggest threat of violence is the enemy. Women in the military, their biggest threat of violence is other men in the military. Yeah. And that stuck with me.
Yeah. And it's true. Mm-hmm. And so but that's what's baffling to me, Kat, is that it's so true. It's been true for so long and it's still getting worse because we just don't listen to it. Like we're still, and I know the police service here in town, victim blamers, like huge.
Oh yeah.
Like the some of the incidents that I was involved with, the victims get put off work and the accused gets to keep working. Yeah. You tell me how that works. You tell me how that's justified or justice for the victim. So you make the victim feel like they're fucked up, right? Because they're going through all this stress. I mean, I know like our culture likes to think, well, it's not that big of a deal. It's just a sexual assault, right?
Okay.
Of course, it's not a big deal when you don't want it to be a big deal because you don't want anything to change, right?
Yeah.
But then they take the victims, they take them out of work because they're struggling, obviously. Mm-hmm. They're having stress and PTSD for the most part. If you've been raped, that's part of it.
Yep.
I hate to burst your bubble out there, Popo, but like, PTSD is a fucking result of it, right? And I know that like within those systems, they try to separate one PTSD from another, right? So they say our PTSD is more important. We went to war. We saw dead babies.
Yeah.
We do these things. And don't get me wrong, that is a very apt description of what can cause PTSD.
Absolutely.
100%.
Yeah.
But what also can cause it is being raped. And what also can cause it is being marginalized continuously by the system.
And constantly sexualized in any context, you know? And that to me is like, oh, well, you're a woman, you're wearing this, you're doing that, you're just out on the street being a femme person. And
so it's your
everything
fault.
About you is sexualized, right? Yeah. It's like, hold your keys in your hand, like all of that type of stuff. Yeah. I mean, and I still do those things because it is unsafe being a femme representing person. Yeah. I'm, for all you listeners out there, I'm a tall woman. Mm-hmm. I am 6'1", and when I go out on outreach or I'm walking down the street or I was, you know, back in the day before a car waiting for a cab, I would put my hood up and I would try to replicate looking like a man because I would be less likely to be attacked. Yeah. And that to me, and it's not something that I actively wanted to do, but if I could hide in my clothing away from my femininity, I felt safer. Mm-hmm. And that to me is disgusting.
It's gross, but it's exactly what I did to become. I had to pretend to be more masculine my whole life. And it wasn't always, and I know some people probably think I just blame people, but that's not what it is. It's more, I just read cues.
Yeah.
It wasn't like anyone said, you shouldn't do this, because I was not going to be telling anybody I was queer. So it didn't matter. Nobody was going to be like, oh, you should probably hide being queer.
Yeah.
I didn't have to have someone tell me that. I grew up in a church where everything that was queer was going to hell.
Yep.
Everything that was out of the norm was going to hell. Literally anything besides missionary position was going to hell.
Yeah.
Right? And if it wasn't with your partner, like your husband or wife, then you're going to hell. Like,
yeah.
And then they change those rules as time goes on, just like the 12 steps, right? They start watering it down. Like, like the Pope, right?
Yeah.
Like Pope got on TV and was like, yeah, we don't think it's a crime to be homosexual. It's just against our law, our views, or something like that. And I'm like, who gives a fuck what you think?
Yeah.
Like, you're a fucking 90-year-old white man.
Mm-hmm.
You work for one of the biggest organizations on planet Earth, and you think we should listen to you about morality. Go fuck yourself.
One of the largest institutions that has killed, like...
caused the most
millions
harm.
Millions of people.
Yes. I was going to even venture to say potentially billions if we
there you go.
Connect all those dots, right?
I'm not great at math, so it probably is billions.
Yeah, I would say because they've been at it for a while.
Oh my goodness.
So, and they don't always report, obviously, like the thousands of babies we found here. Right?
That's the thing, right?
They're not going to always tell us what they've done.
Yeah, and... you know. That's where when we come back into like institutionalization and we start talking about like, okay, let's pray to God and everything will be okay. Go to 12 steps. Do your 12. Did you do your fourth step? Have you done your inventory? That's why you're messed up. Do another fourth step.
Fuck, you say those things and it makes me cringe because I'm sure I've said that before, right? Like,
Yeah.
Like we got to do this fourth step or else we're just not going to get over the stuff. And it's like, oh.
Can we just talk about how dangerous and traumatizing that is to do with a non, like someone that has not gone through some sort of training in which that they are not, it's dangerous for both people involved.
Even if you've had training, it's dangerous.
There you go, right? Because it's like, who's training who, like back to control. It's just, when we start to just go into ragtag support group that isn't just human to human talking like us now, but it's like, oh, and we got to follow these rules.
I set out for you.
Yeah.
Because I have time.
Exactly. Yeah. I have had friends that have very privileged and went through a lot of the institutions back down in California. That some of these are like resorts if you can afford
like
them.
Betty Ford and shit like that.
Yeah. And she's like, yeah, I was at this, my sponsor at the time, who was someone, they had like this weird graduation model where people would come back for unpaid labor, of course, and be sponsors in these systems, right? Like a lot of the systems here in Alberta do this too.
Oh yeah, and they have their alumni associations for free labor,
And she gave her this workbook and she said, okay, I want you to write down every sexual encounter that you've ever had. And we're going to talk about how it's, how all of your sexual encounters and the ones that you aren't proud of are ones that are, and that's how it's tied to your addiction and using again will make you do these sexual things that you're not proud of. And she was like, I'm not proud. Like it was so, she was like, they set it up for me immediately to assume that like,
you're ashamed.
I should be ashamed for the sexual, proclivities or my sexual needs or like how
or
those things
deviations.
Were met. Or deviations from some sexual norms. And she's like, I didn't do it. I lied. She's like, I had so many more things that I could have written on there, but I thought that me doing that was actually going to cause more trauma and more harm and make me probably want to medicate with my substance of choice instead of being able to move forward. One of the best things a mental health professional ever said to me, I walked in there and I was like, okay, I guess it's time for me to start unraveling my traumas again. And he was like, no, we want to figure out where your life is now so you can continue to like grow and learn and feel better moving forward. We don't need to just unpack a bunch of dirty shit.
And just sit in it.
And sit in it. He's like, we don't do that anymore. And it was the most refreshing thing I have ever heard from a mental health professional. And it honestly changed the way that I looked at everything because growing up in 12 step, again, you're constantly doing these
inventories
and like I was involved in Alateen very, very young. So now you're looking at, as a youth, you're looking at doing the 12 steps, looking at your level.
You might as well have went to Sunday school, really.
It's very similar, right? Yeah. Like I did kind of go to church-ish growing up, but it was like off and on. Like 12 step was the church, right?
Well, it becomes that, for sure.
Yeah, and it took that space and it becomes something that you can immerse your life in. Like they do 90 meetings in 90 days. Like I bet I could look up somewhere, like how long does it take to indoctrinate people? Probably 90 days. And you
maybe
know,
30 to 90.
Oh Jesus. And then just the performativity of the chips and like shaming people. Like there are so many people that like tie their, like their social, status, their social capital to how many years they have clean. Like, do you know how many people I have actually talked to and been like, oh yeah, you know, I had a drink once, you know, but that wasn't my drug of choice. So I still have my 10, 15 years kind of like, you know, offline.
Yeah.
But those are the people that are the, oh God, what do they call them? Old timers.
Yeah.
Those are the old timers that the newcomers should learn from. And you're like,
that's interesting you bring that up because specifically one of the reasons I drifted away from it was because I didn't want to be an old timer.
Yeah.
I was like, the last thing I want is to be one of these creepy old fucks who thinks they're not creepy. And it's like, I could very easily think that if I stayed and continued with the like doing stuff I didn't believe in. Right.
Yeah.
And so that was part of it. I was like, I don't want to be a fucking old timer, man.
Yeah.
Because old timers in this program are fucking gross.
Not
all of them, but of course, the majority.
In my experience, all of the mask folks, predatory men, fucking disgusting. Yeah. And, you know, as someone who has spent a lot of time hanging out with the boys, I was in very, like in the, you know, in Silicon Valley, I was more on the tech side. I did a lot of just, you know, working in music scenes, even on the, like the more technical side of things, you just hang out with more men. And I never felt reduced to being a woman in those spaces. But when I went into 12-step or I went into church, like I was reduced to a woman. I was reduced to this temptress that was there to not only gain sobriety, but to tempt these old timers into fucking me.
What, like seriously, oh my God, I can't get over that. Sorry, continue.
It's that Adam and Eve apple bullshit, like all over again. So every time people go like, oh, well, your higher power can be a doorknob. And I'm like, well, the doorknob is still sitting in this white supremacist patriarchal system. So until we start to unravel that piece of it, like, fuck your doorknob, fuck your God. Because all it's doing is continuing to harm me and others like me, you know?
Yeah, 100%. And when I hear someone... When I hear you say reduced to being a woman, I'm like, what the fuck is wrong with our goddamn planet that being a woman is reducing to something?
Oh, yeah.
Because to me, we were raised mostly by our mom because dad worked and did all that stuff.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean he wasn't there. It just means mom was pretty much the child raiser, right?
Yeah.
Because that was the rule.
Of course.
Was the normative role within the church, like you said. You are a preacher's wife. That is all you are.
Yeah.
That is what you are. You will do what we need you to do.
Mm-hmm.
You won't get paid for it, right? Free labor. And you'll be grateful. Eventually, you'll learn to be grateful for it because it's sacrifice for God, right? Like, seriously.
Yeah. And,
I mean, who's not going to get mad at that? Like, I would. If I was a woman, I'd burn that fucking shit down and be like, you got to be kidding me.
Yeah.
Right? We're still talking about this shit? It's like the affirming stuff.
Yeah.
Give me a fucking break. As long as you still think I'm going to hell, go fuck yourself.
Yeah. Right?
You can affirm whatever you want. But if you think that we're going to hell because we're two-spirit, LGBTQ+, whatever we are, fuck you. Yeah. And the Pope, fuck you too. Right? Like, with all that, with his moral bullshit and our churches and our government. Sorry, I get off on a tangent.
It's all interconnected in so many different ways. Like, we look at, like, that fear of going to an eternal damnation space, it's just replicated in the fear of the carceral system, the fear of being locked away in jail, away from, you know, all of the fact that we take people away from nature and where they put these spaces, you can't even look at a tree and you can't look at the sky.
Yeah. Things people need to feel well.
Yeah, truly. Like, you know, sunshine's important. They literally, like, peddle these lamps to us because we live in, you know, Canada, you know.
In the winter.
Because we live in a winter place is a better way to put it.
Yeah.
I'm like, you're literally starving people of the things that they need to thrive is to be basic human beings.
And doing it on purpose.
And then they go, oh, hey, and now we're going to release you without any sort of post-incarceration supports.
Yeah.
Good luck. Pull up your bootstraps. Be in society again. But and the only thing that's keeping them potentially going that line is fear of going back, is fear of going back into that system.
And so from one system to another, right? And so we start to, they obviously, folks who've been to prison probably decide this is a better system to be a part of out here, right? But I can understand why lots of my friends have gone back many times, right?
Yeah.
It's because this system is not really any better. It's just we can go outside.
Yeah.
Like, it's and I know that people are going to be complaining, oh, Canada's got it so good. And I'm like, you know what? You who are out there saying Canada's got it so good, it's got it good for you. Okay, and Canada is good for me too. I'm not gonna lie. I'm not gonna pretend that I'm not a white man in Canada because I am, right? And so it's really good for me too. Difference that is that it's not good for everybody, and I am not okay with it being good just for me. Like, that's not okay anymore. Like,
exactly.
And or just people like me. That's not okay. Like, if Canada wants to have a C and not a K in it, a triple K Canada, well then Canada needs to do some new shit.
Yeah.
Starting, of course, first and foremost, with the Indigenous folks.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Like, land back is no joke. So when I see, like, the city of Calgary, like, this is all over the news right now. They're like, oh, hey, we're talking about rezoning. Like, and I'm not even going to make a comment on rezoning right now. But I'm like, how can we, in the same breath, talk about rezoning
and truth and reconciliation? Yeah.
How do you wrap those frickin' packages together?
I know.
You know, we start with a land acknowledgement and they go, how are we going to capitalize and parse out this land for her? I think that they need to, like, retake some of these courses or really do some actual deep work with folks being affected because just like that anti-racist conference, right? I should do anti-racist hand quotes.
Yeah, that's exactly what we got to do.
You know, I'm like, they do this thing and like, oh, we're talking and we're listening and we're learning. And I'm like, okay, how much more learning do we have to do and acknowledging before we start going into action?
And maybe you can tell me this.
Yeah.
How much learning do you on anti-racism do you think we're going to get from the police chief of Calgary Police?
Right.
Like, seriously, what the fuck?
That it's so wildly inappropriate for him to be
anywhere near it.
Yeah. Outside of sitting down, not saying a freaking word, and listening to people who have been affected by his system that is killing people and ruining lives.
Yeah. Because I can assure you, he's not listening to his other members of the executive.
No.
He's a dictator, right? Like, and that's what they all say.
Yeah.
Because he's a dictator.
Yeah.
Because he's a bully.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And, you know...
But good, he should speak on that.
It's like, and this is the thing, is like, we keep trying to work in, they go, okay, well, how can we shove anti-racism and truth and reconciliation into the current system that we have and make it work for everybody?
Well, make some money for us and...
Yeah. Exactly. And I've been, like you were saying, like, I've been kind of dancing between these two spaces lately, and it's painful and it's a lot of work, but I think it's necessary because I am a white person. I'm a highly educated white person who has kind of seen the other side because of poverty, and I got out largely because I am white and I was able to access programs through education to be able to even have a voice in that.
Yeah.
So if I'm allowed to be and I'm accepted into these rooms and I can skirt the system a little bit and then be like, cool, I'm glad we're all around this table. Let's talk about why it's bullshit. Yes, that's uncomfortable. It sucks. But I think that that work is 1,000% necessary. And
100%.
And it made me understand a little bit. It's like, dismantling white supremacy, that's white people's job. Because we have access into those rooms and into those spaces. And we're
the only ones who can fucking change it.
We're the only ones that can change it. And every time, like, and I used to think this way too. And it took me doing a lot of work and not just sitting around and learning and listening and not paying the labor of people telling me these things. But I had to be like, wait a second. So tokenizing really got this in for me, right? Yeah. And watching people be tokenized as recovered addicts and alcoholics. And I'm like, okay, well, I know that those people are being tokenized because that's an identity I can relate to. And I said, so now they're cherry picking people of certain racialized and indigenous identities that are willing to go up behind this podium and say, oh, this system, the white system actually worked for me. And let me tell you why.
Yeah.
And they're deciding that that's truth and reconciliation. And it's not.
No, because like this is where we start finding out about that internal lateral violence amongst those intersectional groups of humans,
right?
Marginalized humans, is that if we can get invited to the table, what is one thing that a marginalized human has always wanted? To be invited to the big boys table, right?
Yeah.
So that you're not feeling like an outcast.
Exactly.
I feel that way as a queer person.
Like,
I very do feel that would be like, and I know they got me kind of with that for a little bit with the cops in terms of me being the only queer person in the section I was in. But of course, in the long run, that's just wore me out because that system's not changing.
Yeah.
So those people don't get, it's unchecked all the time. You have literally preachers in the room with me, a queer person who's openly queer, and they're giving their little mini sermons about how God's love is only for a man and a woman.
Yeah.
Not even connecting the dots that I'm sitting right in the fucking room with them. Like, that's how, I'm not 100% sure it's overt anymore.
Yeah.
I think it's really a part of that system to the point where that preacher legitimately thinks that's what they should say, right? That's true. Obviously, I mean, I don't want to get into religious stuff because I don't really believe in God, right? So the idea of it is absurd to me now, but it wasn't always, right? It was like a journey to get to that absurdity, I think, where, again, like we were talking about, if you tell me that God is love, I'm going to say you're a liar because nothing, absolutely nothing about this planet, about the universe, says it's about love.
Yeah.
Everything says it's about chaos and creation and destruction and all of those things that are very much real.
Yeah, exactly.
Right? And part of our nature, you know?
Yeah.
But I think that's part of what religion does, is tries to block out our nature.
It does. And, right? and it divorces us again from the material realities of the world. It goes, well, if you struggle here, that means that you're going to get a better planet or a better space in heaven and that you're going to have the biggest castle in all the land if you suffer and you starve and you the free labor of the preacher's wife. Like all of these things tie into each other and you go, oh, it's just so much better if I know and I am able to do that, then I will have
yeah.
a lifetime of greatness to look forward to. Mm-hmm. And to me, I'm like, okay, as someone who is very analytical and very logical and mm-hmm. very like, I need to see it, I need to be able to touch it, I need mm-hmm. to be able to understand it. That to me is almost like gaslighting me into accepting a state of impoverishment mm-hmm. because it's better for me.
Yeah.
And
well, if it wasn't yeah. better for you, God would not have you there.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. God only gives his like toughest battles to his best warriors.
Oh God.
My God, I have so much cliche coming up.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm for it. No, just fake it. I could do the 12 step, fake it till you make it.
Well, I know, right? And you hear these things everywhere. So it's not just like, it's not just amongst like people in recovery, although it does happen quite a lot with people in recovery where it's like, oh, you know, God only gives you what you can handle. Well, what if God didn't give you shit?
Yeah.
What if you just have this shit because you have this shit, because life is shit?
Yeah. Like,
I know we don't want to think that, and that's negative, and people out there are like, oh, David, you just need Jesus. I don't, by the way. But what we do need is, like, obviously, a free conversations about these things
yeah.
with anyone we want, right? Like, at a certain point in time, the whole, like, Christianity, Catholicism stuff, like, I get people still think that's sacred. I mm-hmm. do. But, like, to me, what shows me it's not sacred at all is that they murdered a bunch of people.
Yeah.
And then tried to hide it, like they do, right?
Exactly.
So, like, in my mind, that's not helpful. Even if there are so many people, and I know there are, that will absolutely attest to their faith being the beautiful thing that gives them purpose in life and mm-hmm. all of those things, I get it. I wanted that too.
Yeah.
And when I could feel that way, I know exactly what you feel like. Because you're like, oh, this is for real. Like, this stuff is real. Because you know what? Mm-hmm. Once I started, like, really getting into the tasks of those, like, belief of the fake it till you make it. Mm-hmm, okay? Because mm-hmm. I was fake it till you make it for sure.
Yeah.
It was faking the prayers, faking the meditation. It was, you know, regurgitating the garbage in the meetings. Just so you didn't get called out, right?
Like, totally.
Yeah, and like those things, I didn't always do that, but sometimes for sure I did, because I was mm-hmm. like, I fucking hate this program. I don't want to talk about it. But then they'd ask you to share, and you're like, oh yeah, it's a great fucking deal.
Yeah,
like,
I know.
Being sober is so much better, and the truth is, it was better for me
yeah.
to not drink, right?
Yeah, like, totally.
But again, I'm not one of those people who says you're not sober if you do other things.
No, I know, same.
Yeah, right? That's I just look at it like,
silly.
You can tell me if you're sober or not. Yeah. I don't care. It's not my business.
Yeah,
if you want my help, I'll absolutely help you. But
yeah.
if you don't, I'll just sit with you and have coffee too. Like,
yeah.
it's okay.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's the thing is like recovery, like that term, it's such an important term to me, and it's being mm-hmm. perverted and skewed in so yeah. many ways, probably in the same way that like those people who are like their faith is beautiful for them mm-hmm. and everything else. And I know people that are disgusted by the way that it's been politicized and used mm-hmm. for colonialism and used as reason to take over and kill mm-hmm. people. They're like, that's not yeah. what God's about. But those people are so few and far between, and yeah. probably why they're in my circle of trust, mm-hmm. being able to have that conversation, because for so long, conversations about religion or about mm-hmm. any sort of queerness or, you know, control of self over mm-hmm. my, you know, cis femme body mm-hmm. Was something that God had to have control over, mm-hmm. right? And that if I broke those codes, if I were to be actively queer, or if I were to, you know, have an abortion, right, mm-hmm. or take birth control, or do something to have control over my body in that way, that I was somehow being ungodly, mm-hmm. and that meant that I was being damned forever into eternal, fiery, or icy, depending on what circle of hell you're in, just to bring up Dante a little yeah. bit.
I like it whenever Dante's introduced as
yeah.
good.
Fair enough, day. Fair enough. Yeah. and so, like, you're going through this weird journey of mythology mm-hmm. into a place where it says, okay, if you don't, this is how bad it's going to be. Mm-hmm. And they do that same thing in 12 step. If you yeah. drink again, if you use again.
Yeah.
And for some people, that's not true, right? And
100%.
And for
true.
Others, yeah. like it could be like, I like back to that $100,000 thing. I don't know if I took that money and I took that shot, that I'd be like, well, if I took one, maybe I'll be able to take two or three. Cause I know that now, that's how my brain does work, mm-hmm. at least historically. Mm-hmm. And And I just don't have the energy to do it.
For sure. Do you think your brain works that way because it was taught to work that way, or do you think it works that way because that's true?
I think it's because I was taught to work that way. Yeah. And I absolutely think I was taught to work that way. Because
it's either or yeah. or not, right?
Like, yeah, exactly.
That's what I was taught too. It's yes or no.
Yeah.
You either drink or you don't.
Exactly.
You either use drugs or you don't.
Exactly.
All drugs are the same.
Yeah. I mean, and I'd also say through experience, just because, like, you know, I've had periods of not drinking alcohol. Mm-hmm. And I say that really purposely because I always say perhaps to certain drugs.
Yeah.
Well, you know, ones that I know, I mean, we have a toxic drug supply right now. I'd probably be doing more drugs right now for recreational purposes mm-hmm. if I knew that they could be safe.
Safe, yeah.
But alcohol for me was always the thing that didn't make me feel good about myself, or I couldn't be like, oh, well, that was fun. It yeah. stopped being fun to me. It stopped being recreational.
Yes.
And it started being something that was turning. It wasn't even just like, oh, yes or no, don't drink. Mm-hmm. It was like, if I don't drink, I'm going to get the shakes. Like I was, it was to the point where I was putting like water bottle vodka was like, you know, maybe a little bit of water in there and just so I could drive and not shake. Yeah. Right. And so I could be able to function and go to work. I had mm-hmm. to be drinking.
Yeah.
Like it had become so ingrained with like my bodily functions mm-hmm. that to me was like, okay, this isn't recreational yeah. anymore. This is medicinal. And not to bring in this whole like, you know, medical model disease mm-hmm. of addiction or anything, more of like, that was real and tangible to me, mm-hmm. unlike this pink cloud idea of sobriety being mm-hmm. like, oh, well, your life is going to be better and all these other things mm-hmm. are going to happen. And I'm like, well, I tried that. I had years sober mm-hmm. and then life was still really, really bad that mm-hmm. I ended up having this like, why try at all? Case of the fuck it's. There's another mm-hmm. one from 12 Step.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I may as well try drinking again. And I just accepted the fact that I didn't drink normally.
Mm-hmm.
So whether I was hiding under this guise of mm. drinking normally or being like, I'm just going to accept the fact that I'm a lush, that I'm a drunk, that mm-hmm. this works for me. Like the problem was always the behavior of drinking in response mm-hmm. to some sort of internal or external stimuli I was dealing with.
It's a coping mechanism.
So it was, yeah, exactly. I always, mm-hmm. like, addiction is a coping mechanism. It's yeah. a way for, it's a, like, we talk about brain disease model, all this other mm-hmm. things. I think it's more akin, and I didn't make this up, I read this somewhere, but someone writes about how addiction is more like a learning disability,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, my autistic ADHDs thought that was very interesting.
Oh, my brain's like, that's pretty interesting.
I was like right? And I was yeah. like, when I think about it, I'm like, I learned how to deal with behaviors by drinking them away,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's what sticks with me. It's mm-hmm. not even the thing I grew up with. So like, yeah, I do think I was taught all those things. And of yeah. course, that is still part of the stuff that's coming out of my mouth mm-hmm. right now. I don't want to act like I've somehow escaped the grand narratives that I've been taught.
I haven't transcended nothing, so.
Yeah, exactly.
We're like, just trying.
Yeah, I know. I'm just trying to, like, figure out everything around here. Yeah. But it was that material reality of being like, I need this outside thing
mm-hmm.
to function.
Yeah.
Was like, okay. And then it started to affect my life in a variety of ways outside of, like, okay, well, water bottle vodka while you're driving around when you are an immigrant in this mm-hmm. country can get you kicked out back into a space where you don't have family, mm-hmm. right? You don't have supports.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't have that network anymore. Like it just becomes that fear system again, right? Mm-hmm. And the last time that I quit drinking, which again was a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. I didn't go to 12 step. I didn't do any of those things.
Mm-hmm.
It just hit me that I was like, I can't keep living this way.
Yeah.
Right? Like I literally couldn't afford it. It was getting yeah. to the point where I was going to have to start stealing alcohol again, mm-hmm. which I'd never done here when I lived here,
yeah.
but I definitely did back in the States. Mm-hmm. And you know, there was, I mean, that comes back to that carceral yeah. fear again and like all this control over me. But like at the very end, like I am happier with myself and the way that I'm able to engage in the world mm-hmm. when I'm not drinking. And the fact that that is a personal choice and I didn't have this random disease or this mm-hmm. this thing that God put down on me and said, sucks to be you. You don't mm-hmm. get to have the wine during, what's it called? Confession.
Passover.
Whatever.
Communion.
Communion, yeah. Yes, the bread and the blood. And
it's been
that's
a while.
Weird. Yeah, exactly. So I remember when I would go back.
It hasn't been long enough, but it's been a while.
Well, yeah, and they'll offer grape juice to people that don't want the wine. And I'm like, I think that's really strange and a ritual that's supposed to.
I fucking participated in that too. It's why I shake my head.
Yeah, it's so out of control. But
every time I did, though, I always felt like a fraud. But
no, 1,000%.
Because I was a fraud for sure.
I
wasn't a believer, so I was a fraud, right? So.
Yeah. I just always thought it was ritual, and that was the point of religion. Because I still don't understand it.
It's all ritual and control, right?
Exactly, right? And not to bash ritual. That's human and necessary.
We fucking need it.
Control is another situation. But yeah, not being that was why I quit, and that was because it was destructive to me, and I realized that on my own. Mm-hmm. And it was during COVID, so I was very alone, right? It was to the point where I was drinking so I could be able to go to my job at the time. And because we were wearing masks, you were able to hide the smell better. And we were distanced. It was a way for me to be in my own little world. Mm-hmm. And once that I was kind of... I couldn't run into these other places or even into be okay, well, commit me to the hospital. I need support, or I need these control systems to make me better. That was when I was maybe it is me now. Maybe I get to decide. And that was liberating.
Yeah.
Not even have,
just being able to choose.
Being able to choose. Yeah. That's really what it was. Being able to choose and not feeling like I had to jump into all of these other places that I'd been told were the right thing for me.
Yeah.
And now it's just so natural that I don't think about it. If people go, oh, do you want a drink? I just say, no, thank you. I don't need to go on this big rant about how I'm in recovery.
Wait, so you don't tell people, you don't say no, because when I have drinks, I break out in handcuffs. You don't say that?
Oh, God, no. Oh, fuck, that's a good one. I haven't heard the handcuffs before. That's hilarious.
I've heard it 1,000 times from 1,000 different people over the course of a couple of years. It's just so ridiculous.
Oh, my God.
As if every time you drank, you broke out in handcuffs. Give me a fucking break.
Yeah, right?
Robert Downey Jr. says it once, and it's got to be gold, right?
No, Jesus.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm pretty sure that's where it came from.
I can almost hear that in his voice when you say it out loud.
Which, fair enough. Some people it's true, but
no, and
not everybody,
it.
Obviously.
And because, I said, there's this reverse stigmatization that you experience, especially when alcohol is your trouble, because it is so ubiquitous in our social culture that you have to almost be coy and quippy with it or say something else. No thank you has started to work for me, but I'm pretty firm about it.
No thank you is a good thing to say.
It's pretty, pretty basic. Yeah. And maybe I just surround myself with people now who go oh yeah, that's a choice. It's fine. No worries.
And that does make a difference who you're around.
Absolutely.
Right? 'Cause if you have people around who go, oh yeah, you should be drinking or you shouldn't be drinking. It's like the opposite effect sometimes, right? When people were like, well, you shouldn't be doing that. And it's like, how the fuck do you know what I should be doing?
Exactly.
This was what I always said to people in the rooms, right? Was like, look, you don't know what I should be doing. I don't know what you should be doing. I don't give a shit what you're doing.
Yeah.
If you don't drink, that's up to you, right?
Yeah.
But other stuff, none of my fucking business. Right?
Yeah.
And my business is none of yours, right? But in those rooms, that everyone's business becomes everyone's business, right? Because you're... functioning in that cult atmosphere where, and I say cult, yes, I said it on purpose, because it is a cult atmosphere where you are absolutely sharing the same idea over and over again in a regurgitated fashion in order to believe it. Now, that doesn't mean that everyone will believe it, of course not, but there'll be atheists and stuff like that. But what happens to all the vocal atheists? They don't come back.
No.
Because it's so uncomfortable. And I felt that too, and I've been there for a long time.
Yeah.
But I was still I don't believe anymore. This is not for me. It was just obvious for me. It was time, right? And because I didn't want to fake it anymore. I don't believe I need to fake it. I can just say, you know what? I don't believe. I don't need to believe. I still haven't wanted to drink since I've left. And I don't believe Now, I could be wrong. Maybe in a year we'll prove it me wrong. But I don't believe that's why I drifted away from AA. I don't believe it's because I want to drink. Even though that's what they would have me believe.
Totally.
Right? And probably my friends in those rooms are like, oh my God, he's probably drinking, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, but I'm not. And the reality is, I haven't even thought about it.
Yeah, truly.
Mm-hmm. Even though my dad died last year, and he's my best friend, I haven't thought about it.
Yeah.
And I haven't thought about it, not because I didn't used to drink a lot and have all kinds of problems happen. It's because I've gotten used to not drinking and looking at the fact that the way you described it, I can now make this choice because I realize how destructive my drinking was for me. I don't know what other people's is or whether people should or shouldn't. That's none of my business. What I do know for me, though, is I shouldn't.
Like, yeah.
And so I just continually try not to, right?
Yeah.
Because that's just one of those things that I know for me, it changes me, right?
Yeah.
And I felt it. And like every time I don't want to like mirror what people say in the room so much, but like the truth is, I didn't always get in trouble.
Right. Yeah.
At the end of my drinking, I wasn't always in trouble. I had a lot of fun.
Like, yeah.
But there was also mixed in with that fun was like a couple of suicide attempts, right? So there was the dark side, of course, that was starting to happen more and more. But I think that's because drinking naturally gets more destructive. As we surrender to it, like as I surrendered to the problems, it just became more destructive.
Yeah.
Because I was more destructive.
Yeah.
Right? And I'm not taken away from the 12-step rooms where people can get well, because I know that it does work for people, not everybody, of course, and it's designed for people like me for it to work, straight passing white males. Like 100% was made by us for us.
I mean, if other people don't have the 12-step lore like in their minds right now, just Google for the wives, and that will show you how white and cis this program is. And you talk about it being a cult, and it's like there's a, like Synanon is a great example of 12-step gone awry, where it becomes Synanon is one of the, another thing for everyone to Google, is one of the biggest cult systems that has come out of 12-step, because they're like, oh well, what if we took 12-step but we made it hardcore, we started yelling at people and using that like negative therapy where you tear people down. And
which I've heard in the rooms.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like the shame that comes out of the 12-step spaces is built into it on purpose because the people that created it thought like Christians. They thought that that was the way to help.
Yeah.
And that is, we know that that is not the case now. Mm-hmm. That tough love doesn't work in this sort of way.
Mm-hmm. And tough love means something different. Besides, in my mind, tough love is not like shaming someone.
Yeah.
Tough love is like, I'm just going to try to give you the truth as best I can.
Even though
the truth might be uncomfortable and hard to hear, right?
Like, yeah, totally.
If I was going to say that to someone, it would be like, look, your drinking concerns me because I think you're going to die.
Yeah.
But that's about as tough as it gets.
Well, that's compassion and concern. And those are important factors, I think,
and just the truth, really,
right?
But that tough love, I think, has gotten such a tough name because people have taken it to mean how they deliver love. So they kind of use it in whatever way, just like any sort of religious thing. You just take it and use it how you want, right? Mm-hmm. This is tough love. I'm not mad at you. I'm just being tough with you. I've heard that shit through the years.
And yeah. It's
like over and over again where you just like, you sense someone has just been abused by their sponsor. I know we're going somewhere.
No, I know. It's okay. I'm about to B-roll.
Yeah. So anyway, are we on track? Is there anything else you want to talk about? What are you up to now? Like, we talked lots about like obviously religion and stuff. Like, cause I know that you're involved. Are you involved with harm reduction?
Yes. I'm deeply involved with harm reduction.
I was going to say, I know that, but for some reason I didn't want to say I know something.
So. No, fair. Yeah. Thank you. So harm reduction is important to me for a variety of reasons. One of which is I probably wouldn't be around if the toxic drug system was the way it was because my mom would have been dead before she had me.
Okay.
Right? So I think about it that way a lot. And it makes, the system is just so messed up right now in Alberta. It's messed up in California. It's across the board. I think that we have taken the idea that we have dehumanized people who use drugs so much that we're calling them zombies on a regular basis. Same with people with mental health concerns.
Fucking junkies, twitchies, whatever people call us.
Right? Yeah. And but at the same time, we replicate these almost like as a quip or that it's funny. We have a place here in Calgary called Pie Junkie, right? Mm-hmm. You got, I think that your business might be fine. Change your name. Massage addict, or massage. I got the word right. Addict. And then Cinnaholic. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, please tell me how many cinnamon rolls you ate that ruined your life, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, maybe that is the case for some people, and I'm not trying to degrade, like, you know, food addiction here or anything along those lines, but, like,
of course not.
How are you degrading things like alcoholism and addiction that you say are so bad when you're saying, like, oh, you know...
Come to Pie Junkie, have a nice pie, you'll want another one.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, you know, you want cinnamon rolls that are going to keep you coming back for more? Mm-hmm. Like, keeping coming back for more is not something that we want, right?
Unless it's positive. Food.
Yeah, unless it's food or unless it's not sex, but the idea of it.
Well, unless it's like standard sex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Standard cis sex.
Yeah, exactly. But we'll sexualize every single product so we can just get involved in, you know, it's like
But if we hear you talk about it, we're going to out you as trans.
And if
you're trans, obviously you're a monster. Like,
truly.
Honestly, it baffles me that it's anyone else's business what people are, but I know, like, to use, like, children as the scapegoat, like, this is a scapegoat for my hate, is that I'm worried about my children. Okay, well, if you're really worried about your children, you'll get them out of Catholic schools, you'll keep them out of Catholic churches, you'll mm-hmm. keep them out of Christian churches, because they're a part of this fucking thing, too.
Yep.
But you don't see that happening.
No.
So what I see happening is people, like, more lip service. Let's do it for the children. This anti-trans stuff is about kids. It's not, because you don't give a shit about kids.
No.
This is about you being scared of trans people because you don't understand anything that's not missionary.
And I think it all, like, harm reduction can be put into this too, right? It's
100%.
Like, all of this is a body control tactic. Mm-hmm. When people are saying cis women with birth control, body control tactic. We don't want women to have control over their bodies and when they can have children. Same thing with anti-abortion.
Well,
when we talk about trans kids, it's like they can't have control over their bodies and their identities mm-hmm. because their parents are supposed to. Mm-hmm. And then we replicate the hierarchical system of, like, who gets to tell you what to do with your body and why?
Somebody that we deem is smarter than you.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
And when we talk about harm reduction, we talk about drug use and we talk about substance use, and alcohol is a drug. I'll say the NA thing right now, but I'll throw that in there. Mm-hmm. Is when we talk about
it's a chemical use, like any other chemical.
Exactly. Yeah. So substance use in general is what I'm referring to here. When we talk about meeting people where they're at in harm reduction, that is the most humanizing thing you can do with somebody. Yeah. You don't meet people with an end and say, like, okay, well, we're going to put you in jail or an institution or somewhere else so you don't die. It's the same thing. We care about the children. We care about you not dying. Mm. Do you?
No. Not this province does not.
No. Yeah. The
I would suggest most governments don't. Yeah.
I think that, you know, and this is the hard part about being kind of in these spaces and out of these spaces is being very careful not to become too indoctrinated by the shiny, the new, the, you know, 150,000 plus a year salary, like all of these other things, the paid vacations, the conferences, right? The travel conferences, they're paid vacations. All of these pieces that allow you to be feeling like you made it in society, now you're part of the problem. Mm-hmm. And being able to dance between those two spaces is work. I guarantee it's not as hard of work as just being an Indigenous person in, you know, Alberta right now, being a Black person. Mm-hmm. That work automatically is thrust upon you because of
a thousand times
what
more
you can
work.
See. A thousand times more work.
Yeah.
So anytime I hear people say, like, oh, it's just too hard to, like, hold on to my values while being in these systems and hearing all these things, and I was like, yeah, it is fucking hard, isn't it? Mm-hmm. It's supposed to be hard.
Yeah.
Now, I don't mean to, like, jump on some big Marxist communist train and being like, the struggle, we have to struggle. I mean, we do. But everything's going to stay the same and stay status quo. And the people that want to say, like, oh, well, we can keep the system the same and change it with our conferences and change it with, you know,
that's just a part of the
institutionalism
system.
And treatment centers. Exactly. That's a way to keep the system going. And, like, if you benefit from the current system, there is no impetus for you to overturn it. Why would you? I mean, I don't even blame you at that point if we're going to be real and, like, it's working for you. If it works, you know, you can work it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, oh, my God. it's all back to there, right?
It
works if you work it. And I'm like, yeah, capitalism does work if you work it.
Yep.
Right? And it's
conform or else.
Exactly.
Yep.
And for the people that it's working for, of course they want to keep that system going because they go, well, I want mm-hmm. everybody to have what I have. And I do agree. I think everybody should be wealthy. That would be fucking awesome. Mm-hmm.
Or everyone, at least not have to worry about it.
I know. Well, I even think that the idea of
fucking
wealth,
nice would that be?
It has been perverted. So it's like, we talk about wealth redistribution, right? We have all these anti-poverty things. And I'm like, well, why don't we just pay people more money? Mm-hmm. Everyone goes, oh, incomes are the thing that will help the most. Okay, why don't we start advocating for businesses to pay their workers more money and to, you know, put a cap on some of those profits. Now it's scary. Anti-capitalism, yeah. You're a communist, pinko commie, get out of the country, all this nonsense. And I'm like, okay.
You're a woke commie.
Yeah, woke commie. Oh God, the wokeness bullshit.
Right, yeah.
And I'm like, well, if this is what your system is saying, that we need higher incomes, who controls that? The businesses that pay people, right? And who controls that? The people that legislate and do government. So you can like dance around these subjects all you want and you can put up, you know, as many city council and meetings and assembly meetings and, you know, bills and all this stuff all you want. But until you address the fact that how we've been divorced from our labor and that the only way to accumulate wealth is through stocks and bonds and financialization and nothing that's even like real, that should worry everyone. And the people that keep voting these people into power that are in like the big banks and like, you know, have all of these assets and wealth and other things they don't have, I'm like, are usually poor conservative people. And by poor, I mean like in poverty. These conservative folks who have grasped onto a reality that they go, maybe one more conservative government means that I'll be out of poverty. They have bought so far into this system that they don't realize that they are a pawn in it as well. And that to me is so sad because, you know, the right is so much better at organizing than the left is, right? Like, look what happened with the Freedom Convoy, how much media attention they got, how many like capital resources they had to be able to do that thing. And I'm definitely not saying I'm for that.
No, of course not.
But look at the power that they were able to bring together because they had those resources. The problem I find with like the left and our ways of organizing is we haven't found... We're so interested in our own voices and that hyper-individualism that we say like, oh, we don't want to talk about it. We don't want to talk about it. It's like, well, my ideas and my values, so I'm going to create my little group. And then someone creates their little group and their little group. And I'm like, that's still the system winning by design because they're saying that your individual thoughts and feelings are more important than the collective liberation of all people.
Which, of course, is more important for them.
Exactly, right? Yeah. And it's like... We have to stop buying into this idea that if we create our little group and we're handing out sandwiches or we're doing this thing and the other thing, is that doing the work in the moment? Yes. I'm not trying to degrade that.
No, for sure.
But from a systematic level, we're not really doing shit.
Nope.
We're keeping people in that same system where they're relying on others who have more power and more means to be able to live their lives. And that's what we're against. So yeah, is it challenging? How do you create collective power without hierarchy? I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, that's a good question though.
You know,
yeah.
Like there's like structure is so necessary, but with structure becomes tyranny. So how do we navigate that? I'm not going to be able to answer that question fully. I have some ideas, but if we, you know, we keep like pushing back and looking at different pieces of history and they go, oh, do you want it to be like, you know, like Mao and Lenin and, you know, and Castro and all this other stuff. I'm like, no, like stop putting us just because we want collective action and we want to address what is happening with capitalism or late stage capitalism right now. Like anyone who's like for the free market, like should be infuriated by the way that our systems are,
manipulated
and how businesses are so tied in with governments and just how disgustingly corrupt all of this is. Like the fact that people who are talking about affordable housing right now in parliament and in assembly are landlords, and they're not mom and pop landlords.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
No, it's okay.
Like all of these things, that's harm reduction to me, mm-hmm. right?
Yep.
Collective liberation, housing justice, mm-hmm. food security, yeah. real basics. That is the harm reduction and how we can meet people where they're at. Because they're like, oh, wow, you're living on the street and you haven't eaten in 3 days and you mm-hmm. haven't gotten to use a real bathroom. That's inhumane. Mm-hmm. We should be able to see that right away. Yeah. And the fact that we are peddling.
Well, that's because there's still a percentage of people that are in the peddling market that don't see it as something they want to do. They don't want
to
help.
And that, to right? me, I can't wrap my head around it.
Well, because you're supposed to do it yourself.
Yeah.
That's capitalism. You're supposed to be all by yourself making it happen. That's the American dream.
Yeah.
Right? Well, and the American dream is not different from the Canadian.
Not at all.
Really.
Well, then, to all of those people, I say, no generational wealth. Yeah. Zero. Zero generational wealth.
Yep. Because you know what is generational? It's poverty.
Yeah.
100%. Intergenerational trauma, poverty, like, you name it. But the intergenerational wealth sure doesn't get dispersed. Right?
No. Yeah. So it's like, I'm sorry, but everyone else, like when my parents died, like we had to apply for a special program in California to be able to afford to get them cremated.
Get them, yeah.
Because
it's expensive.
It's very expensive being able to do these things.
It's a fucking industry.
I
worked in the, I worked sort of offshoot in the funeral business for a few years, like doing funerals,
mm-hmm.
and they make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Those funeral homes.
Funeral homes, and then I forget who said it, but someone said something along the lines of, if you want to make money, open a homeless shelter, mm-hmm. right? If you want to make money, open a funeral services area.
Yeah.
You know, play on people's worst fears.
Yeah.
Like, why do people comply and do things? I don't want to be homeless.
Mm-hmm. Well, how did we get in from the cold from a small office into a big building? It's because we didn't have to really sell it. We just had to say it's families.
Yeah, exactly.
They're homeless families. And that is a very good reason to mobilize, right? Is when there's families on the street. Why are the families on the street? It's mm-hmm. not because of, like, nothing. There's a reason why this is happening, right? And it's mm-hmm. something deeper than just these families not being able to, like, manage their bills, yeah. right? Because that was very rarely what the case was, except for when they're managing what they need, food versus rent.
Exactly.
Right? Or even in some cases, what they need are other things for their children, mm-hmm. right? Like, but we still weren't addressing that. We were just addressing as we do, which is what kind of where we're, I think, failing is that all we do is address symptoms. We don't address the problems, right? We don't look at poverty as the problem, racism as the problem, displacement as a problem, right?
Yeah.
Like I've heard over the last couple of weeks, and probably more than I've heard in a long time, that people are conquered people and they need to just get over it,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's powerful shit to me, right? Like, because I'm like, how can you even say that? Like, really?
Yeah.
You're just regurgitating something that you've heard, right? Because the truth is...
Yeah, I was listening to Joe Rogan's podcast one day.
100%, right. Oh, my God, Jordan Peterson and Joe Rogan had this really good conversation about, you know, racialized humans because they would understand.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
Right? Yeah, they would understand, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's kind of like having the chief of police do the anti-racism conference, right? This is the world we live in, where it's just like... If you work for one of these institutions mm-hmm. that is respected, I use quotation marks because mm-hmm. not everybody, that's for sure, respects how you're doing business. But then you have other people from different institutions that are doing the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? That are just there for window dressing to say, hey, look at who we had.
Yeah, exactly.
We didn't have people who have actually been repeatedly marginalized mm-hmm. by this. Just why else would Taylor and Michelle be banned? It's because the chief of police has given a talk.
Exactly.
Right? Like, and both of them are potentially critical of that person, right? Like, and that agency, because mm-hmm. that agency is like, it's lost all its trust. We have no trust in it. Even people who used to like really trust it, like came to terms with the fact that can't be trusted. Like,
no.
Even though you may have people you love that do this job or do a job within those services, the service itself can't be trusted. Because the service will protect itself at all costs.
Exactly.
Right? And that's what the chief is doing with his fucking Wild West shit, right? Sorry, we got back to that.
No, I mean, it all comes back to, like, the carceral state as far as I'm concerned, because it's that control. It's what colonialism wanted. Mm-hmm. We wanted to come here and take over. Mm-hmm. We wanted to manifest destiny, right? Like all of these things that are, I know. Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember learning about Manifest Destiny in America in elementary school as a positive thing. And it's like, look, that's how we came to California, Manifest Destiny. There are missions in California that are still considered high, great tourist spots, and they were residential schools.
Yeah.
Right? They were horrific places of trauma and violence and cultural genocide. And we went to several of them as field trips, as young elementary school students. And I remember walking into the gift shop and it was all Jesus stuff. It was like, I remember buying specifically, because I thought it just looked neat. It looked like a little fairy in a bottle, but it was one of those like mustard seed, Jesus love in a mustard seed bullshit. And I was like, I think back on those times. And I'm like,
and it was being sold on a nation, right? One of the nations down there.
It was at the mission, in the mission where this happened, exactly, right? And it was part of this gift shop. And I was just, as a kid, you don't really know what you're, you know,
of course not,
absorbing or whatever. But when I look back, I'm like, oh wow, they really tried to like beat in the colonialism. Was awesome. Like that's how America came together.
Right from the get-go.
Big heart. I mean, and then I hear that here in Alberta, they're just tearing apart the social studies curriculum for kids and like what they're learning about. And I'm like, oh boy, like they're just, and I think what's so, not even shocking, I'm not shocked by anything anymore. I'm just disappointed and disgusted. Is that they're so open about it because they're like, yeah, we're finally getting back at those lefties and all those smart people. We're going to, you know, the Alberta budget funds a bunch of these, like, you know, shitty private colleges and says, fuck the public system because that's where all the liberals come from. Last I checked, Danielle Smith went to school with Nenshi at the same time. So how do you get two people growing up in that same system coming out in different ways? Well, you know, Danielle Smith's a white woman. They'll start there.
Yeah.
Right? And when you make your money becoming an oil lobbyist and that your self-actualization, the top of your Maslow's hierarchy of needs, because you're able to do that because all the bottom ones are filled up.
Yeah.
Now you're like, oh, I get to replicate these things of power that have been told to me are what make me a better, stronger, successful human being. So when people are self-actualizing based off of like what the system tells them is good, all they're like, you know, climb over their, all the dead bodies to get into your BMW. You know?
Doesn't matter.
Doesn't matter. That's how I feel all of these treatment center folks are doing. It's like the ones that are running it, the ones that are making money off of it. That are talking about the business and operations and how to cut risk and all these things.
And they get
these
on people, there and talk about how much they care about the people they serve.
I'm like, I don't believe you. Because I've been through your systems. I've seen what it's done to people, and I've seen the people that have been successful, and guess what? They're all white. They've
and
all been housed
impressive.
Previous to before, you know? And I'm not trying to degrade, like, their experiences or whatever, any of that stuff, right? It's just...
But how they justify success is very narrow.
And it's built for certain people.
That's right.
Right? And parading around people who have gone through this system is... I mean, we're just commodifying healing at that point, which I guess is what everybody wants to do, privatizing our medical system.
Well, and that's what they've done. That's what we've done in our industry. And we have to come to a close.
No, I know. I was like, I don't even have time anymore.
We have we have another guest coming in a bit, I think about a half an hour. But one of the things that we have to do is stop doing, stop looking at this like a business, right? Like, and I know that we can't because it's capitalism. That's what people do. And honestly, 25 years ago, it wasn't as much of a business. But what with the inception of the Homeless Foundation, which is when I usually when I started, which was 25 years ago, a long time ago, when they first started out, they were like helping people get money and they were doing all these things. And at one point, I think they might have even been helping because they were giving all the money to the people doing the work. Then they started taking the money. Then they started getting greedy. Then they started thinking they knew the answers to the problems. And they, we know they don't because it's worse now. So in 25 years, it's gotten worse. And a big part of that is the Homeless Foundation. Like their placement within all of this as an overseer is problematic. Right? Because they don't have the first-hand experience. And if they do now, then I stand corrected. But you'll have to come and prove that to me. And prove that to me by coming and sitting and talking to me. Because otherwise... I won't buy it because it's just window dressing, right? Like, and those organizations, I believe, are holding back the progress because they're the ones who came forward with the housing first model. And don't get me wrong, Housing First, nothing wrong with it. A wonderful thing to give people homes, right?
Yes.
But what they failed to recognize, even though they were told repeatedly by many people, yours truly, mm-hmm. I might have said something, that it was absurd to think that we could just do that and that was going to solve the problem,
yeah.
right? It wasn't like we said, that's not a good idea. What we said was we need more of an idea, like yeah. to go along with this idea, right? No, Housing First, that's it. So then they went around and they did all their accreditation shit. At mm-hmm. one point, it was the Homeless Foundation going around from agency to agency doing their accreditation. So you tell me if that's like a really good way to do things, is you have the governing body who gives the money out and they're the ones coming in to like make and then teach you how to be accredited and then giving you your accreditation.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, the whole process of that accreditation was yeah. so that the Homeless Foundation would find out whether or not you were viable for them. So they would mm-hmm. come in and whether you'd stand with them.
Right? Yeah, they're vetting you.
100% vetting.
They're vetting you.
Yeah, so anyway, I'm sorry I keep dragging this on.
No, it's a good point. I mean, I guess just to that, how I'll finish it up is, at least for me, these nonprofit systems, mm-hmm. They are not silently, but very loudly saying that we are very much like businesses and corporations, and that's mm-hmm. how they're run. Therefore, we need to find ways to get funding outside of the government funding and move mm-hmm. more towards this, like, the social enterprise model. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, well, we're feeding right back into capitalism. I don't disagree that, like, chasing funding and money isn't, like, mm-hmm. a terrible system the way that it's set up and rife for corruption. There's yeah. all sorts of issues with it.
It sucks we have to do it, but there's got to be a way to do it.
Exactly. But, you know, until people realize, like, it's the social services, we should be trying to work ourselves out of a job.
That's what we used to say all the time.
And I don't think a lot of people see that anymore. They see a full, yeah. like, you can get degrees in nonprofit management, mm-hmm. and that is, like, a full path.
Oh, yeah.
Into rest wealth, of your life. into careerism, yeah. like, all of these other pieces that are causing more harm to vulnerable mm-hmm. people. Right? I'm not trying to, I work in the nonprofit industry.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
me too.
Yeah, right? Like we do this on a regular basis, and that doesn't mean that we can't see the harms that it's causing and creating, mm-hmm. right? You know, back to that original thing where we're talking about police or any sort of institution, mm-hmm. and can we divorce the people and the good that they do from the bad? It's like, I don't know. I think it's more like DNA. It's separate strands, mm-hmm. but they're all interconnected by something. Mm-hmm. And there has to be a way for us to be able to talk about all of the mishmash of threads that have become mm-hmm. so disentangled with ideas of what is normal and what is a productive society.
Mm-hmm.
For us to be able to kind of start to say, okay, well, maybe we need to give people direct money instead of giving it to these organizations and them, like...
Yeah, more like mutual aid.
More like mutual aid, yeah. right, than just handing out these, like, basic cards. Mm-hmm. Because saying, like, okay, well, we'll give you housing if, we'll give you food if, we'll give you this if.
Yeah.
I think we need to have a more humanistic approach, which is, it's about mutual aid, it's about mm-hmm. collectivism, it's about coming together as people.
Yeah.
And...
just so you know out there, we're not talking about communism.
Yeah, wink, I know, right?
Wink. Just kidding.
I mean, yeah I know. Well, after that RCMP report that came out saying, like, hey, by the way,
yeah.
We're really worried about in the next 5 years that there's going to be, like, an insurrection and a revolution.
Well, they should be worried.
I mean, truly, yeah. Because...
Because of housing, but because the RCMP are a bunch of fuck faces. That's why yeah. they should be worried. Sorry.
No, I don't Again. Disagree. And that's where I'm just, like... Even the powers that be are saying, like, hey, we've created a system where social unrest is freaking real.
Inevitable.
Inevitable. So if we want to talk more about social disorder,
mm-hmm.
give people money so they can pay for their basic needs.
Yeah.
And give them autonomy over that money and that cash. I don't need to, like, sling more studies at you. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a space where I'm comfortable coming from academia. But those voices are often overinflated. Mm-hmm. And they are why we are, that's a Western system as well. Wow. That is a Western colonial system that says if we follow these certain steps and we we confine knowledge into this one space, and then we get to accept that that is real. Yeah. We're at a place now where people are very educated. Mm-hmm. We have a lot of media. We have a lot of time and space. There's no more scarcity of media where there's only so many hours a day and so many terrestrial radio stations or television stations or printing presses that exist. We can do this now, and we can hear from real people. Mm-hmm. You've heard them. Do something about it.
Yeah.
All right.
Right on, Kat.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.